Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And a lot of fun stuff is going on in technology, as always. Google is now offering coupons for free coding lessons for women and minorities.
What?
Yeah, 3-month free coding lessons because they're trying to get more women and minorities in their company.
But it's pretty funny they're offering coupons.
Coupons free for 3 months worth of coding, and I'll publish a link to that. I just took me a while to look around and try to find the link. Saudi government's targeting dissidents by putting malware on their phone, and people download an app and they can turn on their microphone, turn on their camera, and do all sorts of things that they want with it. Dropcam sold to Google's Nest for $555 million. That's an interesting company. These guys originally started the company because one of their fathers wanted to find out which neighborhood dog was pooping in the backyard. and so they set up technology to catch the dog.
That's funny.
And they ended up selling that for $555 million. Okay, the FAA has clarified what are proper uses for drones. I think they're getting a lot of heat over.
Do you fall within the parameters? Probably not.
Here's the thing. If I'm just taking pictures for my own personal use, I can. But if you're taking real estate pictures for any commercial objective,
oh, really?
It violates it. So real estate agents can't do it. So now the question is, if I'm taking pictures of the Stratford campus, is that for commercial use? I'm putting it on the website,
okay,
or is that for personal use?
So here's another question. You did this before they came out with the ruling. Are your pictures then grandfathered in, and can you continue to use them?
I'm going to continue to do it. And I'm going to continue to use them. And we'll just see how all that works out.
Okay. I don't have a funny feeling that they're not going to be walking around looking for people there.
I don't think they're going to give a hoot about what I do, actually.
Yeah.
Today we're going to feature Jen Sun Huang. He's the co-founder and CEO of the graphics processor company, NVIDIA.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of funny story. His parents sent him over from Taiwan to live with his aunt and uncle in the U.S., and they sent him to what they thought was a prep school. It was actually a reform school.
Oops.
In Kentucky. So
that's pretty funny.
It is kind of a funny thing, but he managed to do something quite well. And I'm going to share my first experiences in getting on the internet. I'm going to go down memory lane, how I took my original Windows machine, which had no TCP/IP protocol stack, how I installed that protocol stack and got on the internet for the first time.
Wow.
And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant.
Giant mailbag. Mr. Big Boys.
What is going on? You know, I hate it when this thing doesn't. He's coming back into the studio right
Mr.
now.
Mr. Big Boys, take the coffee cup out of your mouth, please. Okay.
There's a letter in your
right.
mailbox.
See, you speak and he listens.
That's it. You know, he comes in here drinking coffee and
smoking
a cigarette. And it's just not a good thing.
No.
We got an email from a Bethesda listener. Dear Doc Schertz, I hope you can shed some insight on this, please. I was sent this by a colleague, and I can't open it. My attachment has been replaced with this message. Access to attachments has been blocked. The blocked attachment is blah, 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 .xml. What do I need to do to use it or to read it? Bethesda listener and fan. Well, here's the deal on that blocked attachment. It's an XML file, which is extensible markup language, and it turns out that many viruses and bad things arrive as XML files.
Yeah.
And so what is typically done in corporate servers is if it's an XML file, they just remove it and block it.
Mm-hmm.
And like at work, I cannot, if I want to send each week, I actually write the Tech Talk podcast, and that's an XML file. And then I send it to somebody at Stratford to post it to the Tech Talk webpage. But the Stratford servers block the XML file, so the only way that I can send them that file is with Gmail. So Gmail doesn't block it, so I can send the XML file with Gmail. So the answer is your corporate servers, it's an Outlook server, just blocking it, and I do not believe you're going to get your IT folks to change that, because it's really good security practice to block it, because too many people open up XML files inappropriately. So if you need to get that file, have them send it via Gmail, and it'll come right through.
Mm-hmm.
Good question. We got an email from John in Woodbridge. Dear Tech Talk, I have a database application that I share between multiple computers. We keep the database itself on a USB thumb drive, and then we move the drive around to various computers as we need it. The database is never copied off the thumb drive. We just keep updating it in place. Seems like really a simple idea, and I love it. But a friend of mine told me that I'm asking for trouble. He said something about the fact that thumb drives can wear out, and that sooner or later, probably sooner, the data on my thumb drive would become corrupt. Is that true? Do thumb drives actually wear out? Love the show. Thanks, John in Woodbridge. Well, your friend was right. Immediately take the information on that thumb drive and back it up to another drive. Thumb drives are not a good place for backup data. They're basically used for temporarily moving things around. Actually, a thumb drive has something what they call flash memory. Now, that means that you basically flash it with a higher voltage, and then once you've flashed it and you've changed the state of the memory cells, you can turn off the power, and it will remember what the flashed pattern was. That's mm-hmm. what's called flash memory. Now, the problem is that you can only flash the memory so many times. Now, the manufacturers rate their drives between 10,000 and 100,000 flashes.
That's a long time, though, right?
Well, okay, let's look at it. If you would, for instance, write to your hard drive 10 times a day, it would wear out in 3 years at that.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, yeah, they're also easily corrupted. If for instance, you have your thumb drive, and while it's writing to the thumb drive, you pull it out, You can corrupt it.
Oh,
quite
sure, yeah.
Quite easily. And now flash memory, they try to extend their life a little bit with a few tricks. What they do, first of all, if a section of the flash memory, some of them have what they call they have circuitry that will identify parts of the thumb drive that aren't properly functioning now, and they will avoid those. They'll avoid those bad bits. You know, they'll just map them out so you don't write to them, and that preserves the length a little bit longer. Some also have what they call wear leveling, so that if you're writing to the thumb drive and you keep writing the same file in the same location over and over and over again, you'll wear out that particular place. So what they do is they move it around on the thumb drive so that you are using all of the all the memory locations equally. But still, it's going to eventually wear out. And using a thumb drive like you're using it is the worst possible thing you could do. It's just, I mean, it's great for transporting stuff, but it's not a backup. So, you know, if you only have it copied one place, it's really not a backup. Now, what you could do, and I think would be a better idea, would be to get an external hard drive. And you can get a 1 terabyte external hard drive for about $64.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the price of a 64 gigabyte thumb drive. And and you just simply plug it in, and that's going to be a lot more reliable than the thumb drive. And so I would recommend that you at least have your database in two different locations and never have a critical data in only one place or the other. And if as long as you back up your thumb drive data to some drive,
mm-hmm.
so you've got backup somewhere, then you could continue to move it around. It's okay, but just keep the backup and just assume that your thumb drive is going to fail someday. Now, you might ask the question, what about solid-state drives?
What about solid-state drives?
Those are flash memory.
Mm-hmm.
And you're using that all the time. Well, it turns out that solid-state drives are higher quality, more expensive flash technology, and they actually last a lot longer. They're also faster than the cheaper thumb drives, and so they last a lot longer. And a typical solid-state drive is going to last longer probably than your computer before you have to replace your computer. So it's not as critical there. But that was an excellent question.
So let me may I have a sidebar with you?
Yes.
So I would assume that there are some thumb drives that are better than others. Are there some particular that you like, or do you just not use thumb drives at all?
No, I use thumb drives
to transport stuff.
Yeah,
basically.
I mean the thumb drives that if it's cheap, it's probably not that good of technology. So
you get what you pay for.
You get what you pay for. And so what I tend to do, I tend to get thumb drives that are more expensive, and I get thumb drives that support USB 3.0. Those are faster thumb drives, so you can copy to them faster. So a 64-gigabyte thumb drive that supports 3.0 is going to be $60.
Can you will only see that on the packaging, or can you determine that by when you plug it in? And
no, it will tell you.
It'll tell you when you plug it in.
And so the really cheap ones that are less reliable are the ones that they give away at trade shows.
I'm going to check my thumb drive right now. Let's
see
what happens.
So you know these little cheapy thumb drives that they give at trade shows you can get thumb drives for like $5.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have various degrees of quality, but I would I really would never use any thumb drive for my actual backup at all. Because this thing of people pulling out the thumb drive while it's copying to the thumb drive, that's very, you know, it's very frequently done where you're in a hurry, you save it to the thumb drive, and then you pull it out and run. But the file's not fully transferred, and then you corrupt your data. It happens many, many times when people get too involved.
Yeah,
we got
sure.
an email from Kim in Florida. Dear Tech Talk, I've heard people talking about a mashup. A mashup. Now, what does it mean? Is it hard to make a mashup?
And do you need potatoes?
Yeah. What is this? Is it sweet potatoes? Or what are you mashing, actually? Love the show, Kim in Florida. Okay, Kim. A mashup is actually a term used in web development, and it's a web page or a web application that uses content from more than one source to create a new service that's displayed in a single graphical format. For instance, you could combine addresses and photographs of your library branches with Google Maps to create a mash map up, which would show the location of all the libraries on the Google Maps.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the term implies easy, fast integration, frequently using open application programming interfaces. These are open APIs. This is a way to access, say, Google Maps. And the data sources that you have are, you can just pull our raw data sources. You can pull off the internet. You just take the data and combine it with the map using the open API. Now, the term mashup originally comes from the British West Indies. It's slang meaning to be intoxicated or as a description of someone who's not quite functioning as intended. So you're taking the data and the map and you're using them in a way that they weren't originally intended in order to get a new look. The main characteristics of a map are a combination of visualization and aggregation. In the past, more and more web applications have published APIs that enable software engineers to easily integrate data and function instead of building them themselves. Mashups are considered to be an active part of the evolution of social software and Web 2.0. In particular, you can access the Google Maps API to put data on, and this API is free. You can create your own mashups with Google Maps. It's free, and they don't charge you any licensing fee for using the API until you get more than 50,000 hits, and then they say, okay, you must be a business, and you have to pay some small licensing fee. Now, those of you that want to, you know, interested in graphical information systems, or you'd like to have sort of demonstration project to show what a hot programmer you are, I'd recommend that you know how to make a mashup. It's the kind of thing you can do over the weekend. It's really, really easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I've done, you can actually just look up Google Maps mashup tutorials, and you'll see a whole list of them. I've actually picked three tutorials that are free on how to make mashups, and I'll put those links in our show outline that I post to the website. And this is just a great demonstration project if you want to show somebody something really clever.
I've learned something today. I just checked my USB, the one that I have that's my like frontline one right now.
Yeah, uh-huh.
It's a 2.0 FD USB device, so it's okay.
It's not great.
It's not.
Yeah.
You know,
how many gigabytes is it?
I think it's like a 7 or so. Hang on a second.
Let me that's see really. They don't sell them in 7. It's going to be like 1 or 10 or 2 or.
It's
32.
It's an 8 gigabyte. Eight gig.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's but it looks cool.
Well, there was a time when that was really a good device, really a hot device. It was the top of the line at one time, probably.
I've got to get an external storage drive because I will.
It's only $64.
I know.
And the thing is small. It's
smaller than a CD, right?
Yeah. It's smaller than a CD. It's smaller than an external DVD drive. It's about half the size of an external DVD drive.
Okay.
And you don't need any power.
It's USB powered.
USB powered. So you just plug it in and it works.
This is what I need to do.
And you can get 1 terabyte or 2 terabytes. So tell me, you were about getting your you got your iPad broken. What was that all about?
Oh, let's stop the music then.
Yeah.
Since we're going to talk about that, I had an iPad Mini that I dropped, broke the glass, and I took it to a place in Clarendon called Wygo. And they fixed it. They did a nice job. It was done in one day. Took it home, and I've had it.
How much did it cost to get that fixed?
It was about $170.
Wow. So it's about $110 for an iPhone. So $170 for the iPad.
iPad, right? Exactly. So but a lot of places, the place that I would normally use in Baltimore that does a really good job, and Apple actually uses them, they won't do an iPad in less than 3 days. And I needed this thing, so I took it over. They did it in about 5 weeks. It started acting really strangely. I would touch something on the screen, and then you could see where it was something. It was like the touch sensor was offset on the screen,
okay.
And then it would start. All on its own, the keypad would open up and it would start typing text to people. So I took it to the place in Baltimore and they said, well, your digitizer is bad. The digitizer, I have now learned, is fused to the back of the glass of the ice cream.
Okay.
Took it to Clarendon last week because the guy in Baltimore said, it's probably still under warranty. Indeed it was. They said, we got a box of bad parts. And so they wound up getting new parts this week, and they replaced it free of charge. And I should get it back today, but it's interesting. I need to figure out where they get these parts from, whether they are it's an Apple part or what it is that they do.
So maybe you should have waited the 3 days in the first place.
Is this pick on Jim Day?
It is. It is.
No, you're probably right. I should have. I probably should have gone to the more reputable place. You know, it's funny. When I asked the guy in Baltimore, I said, I really need this thing for work. Can you give it a rush job? He says, well, I really can't because, you know, we get a lot of business. And I said, well, can you recommend a place? And the answer was, if you want your screen to fall out in a week, I could recommend a place. So
yeah,
there you go. I learn a lot from you, Doc. I
mean, very good.
I pay attention, but
the question is, do you use it?
That's the question. Yeah. Do I use it? So now, but you know what? The iPhone place in Baltimore, they're less than $100 to fix an iPhone,
okay.
And they'll do it in the same day.
Okay, very good.
So there you go.
Very good.
All right, so Doc, we love emails.
We love the emails. Oh, thank you very much.
I'm here to help.
Are the radio professional. We love your emails. TechTalkis@stratford.edu. And also, I'm monitoring the Tech Talk Radio webpage. Go to facebook.com/TechTalkOnline, and I'm watching for your comments during the show.
And we will be back with more of Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2, right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
As today we're going to feature Jensung Huang. Jensung Huang. That's what his mom called
you
him.
You won't have to spell this later, we promise.
Yeah, no, you won't have to do that. Sun is H-S-U-N. That's his middle name. Jensung Huang. It's co-founder and CEO of the graphics processor company, NVIDIA. And I purchased a lot of their graphics cards in the old days when I was just into, you know, modifying and making my own machines. I'm beyond that now. Jensung Huang was born February 17th, 1963 in Taipei, Taiwan. His parents sent him to go to finish a grade school and go to high school in the U.S., and they sent him to live with his aunt and uncle so that he could escape the violence and civil unrest that was going on in Taiwan at the time. Huang's aunt and uncle, they were recent immigrants to Tacoma, Washington, and they didn't speak much English, and they thought that he should go to a very high-quality prep school, and they got a little confused. They actually sent him to a reform school instead of a prep school. They sent him to a reform school for, I guess, criminals. And they sent him to the Oneida Baptist Institute, which is a reform school for, you know, for juvenile delinquents in Kentucky. And, you know, he got three meals a day while he was there, but he had to work hard. He scrubbed all the toilets in the three-story dorm every day. That was his job.
There's dignity in all work.
He shared a room with an illiterate 17-year-old boy who was covered with tattoos and had knife scars. But the thing is, Jensung actually got to know this guy, and he taught him how to read.
Really?
Yeah, and so he actually provided kind of he mentored him. And so he demonstrated a tremendous work ethic with cleaning all these toilets, and then he mentored his roommate. So many people might have felt, you know, why am I in this reform school? He made the best of it. And then while he was there, he learned to play table tennis because the guy who came in to fill the vending machines knew about table tennis. And so whenever the vending machine guy would come in to fill up the vending machines, he and Jensung would play ping pong. And he actually kept working on his ping pong game until he rose to the rank of master. Now, after the reform school mistake, his parents moved him his aunt and uncle moved him to Oregon, and so he could go to high school. Well, he continued to play table tennis in Portland. And at age 15, he placed third in the junior doubles in the U.S. Open.
Wow.
So he became quite the ping pong player. He graduated from Aloha High School, located in the western suburbs of Portland.
You wouldn't expect there to be an Aloha High School in Portland, Oregon, now, would you?
Yeah, I'm thinking you just would not expect that.
Or maybe they just wanted to get rid of the students. Students.
I'm thinking maybe they had some people. Maybe they had a whole group from Hawaii that sort of moved to Portland or something.
Possible.
Now, he received his undergraduate degree in electrical engineering from Oregon State University in 1984, and he got his master's degree in electrical engineering from Stanford University in 1992. Now, while at Oregon State, he met his wife, Lori, who was his engineering lab partner, and they now have two children. After college, he became director of Coreware at LSI Logic. Director of Coreware at LSI Logic, which is a large-scale integration company. He makes these large-scale integrated circuits. And he was also a microprocessor designer for AMD. So he was into the silicon chip business. In 1993, after having done silicon design for a few years, he co-founded with two of his friends, NVIDIA, which was a graphic processing company. They made graphic processing units, and they also make system-on-chip units, SoCs, for the mobile computing market. You see, the idea of the graphics processor, this particularly you need this for gaming. In the old days, you didn't want all the graphics calculation done by your core processor because it was busy doing other stuff, so you'd have a separate processor that would just handle the graphics, and that would allow you to do very sophisticated gamings at high speed, and that was their niche market. I used to really be into that. I mean, I had NVIDIA graphics processors in my machines back in the day, but I'm beyond that now. And so they really made great, great devices. NVIDIA's primary GPU graphics processor unit is called GeForce. And that's in direct competition with AMD's Radeon products. So NVIDIA also joined the gaming industry with its handheld NVIDIA Shield, as well as the tablet market with Tegra Note. Now, Jensung owns a portion of NVIDIA stock. He's worth about $512 million as of 2006. He earned, in 2007, he earned $24 million, and he was ranked 61st highest-paid CEO by Forbes back in 2007. He gave his alma mater $30 million to build the Jensung Huang School of Engineering. And in 1999, Jensung Huang was named Entrepreneur of the Year in High Technology by Ernst & Young.
Wow.
So there you go. There's a man who started out in a
reform school,
but not that he needed reform.
Accidentally,
and he moved all the way up. It's a great success story. It kind of shows how people can come to this country, take advantage of what we have, and build a really valuable company. It's a great lesson on what capitalism can achieve in the United States.
Great story. Hope you're paying attention, because if you know the right answer to the pop quiz coming up here, you will get the tickets for two to the Escoffier at Stratford University coming up. The pop quiz here on Federal News Radio, Tech Talk on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now, It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn.
It's not Alex Trebek.
It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Yes, welcome back to the classroom of the airways. Mm-hmm. Not a radio show.
No.
And those of you that have listened for a while already knew that before I told you. And you also knew that when there's a classroom, there's going to be an assessment. And so in this case, the assessment is a pop quiz. If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, you will get A+ for the day. Plus, you win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room, the Karem Dining Room. So earlier in the show, I was talking about Jen Sung Huang. He, of course, is the CEO and co-founder of NVIDIA. While he was growing up, he came very good at playing what particular sport?
Aha.
If you get the right answer to that, you'll get two tickets to fine dining. As I said, all you have to do is communicate the answer to us.
Now, in order to do that, you should pick up your landline telephone or your cellular and dial us. If you're calling from west of Taipei, Taiwan, it's 877-936-9333. From east of Tacoma, Washington, it's 877-936-9333. From anywhere else, it's the wild card line, 877-936-9333. Or you probably have
yes, if you're calling in from Mongolia... You can reach us by Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1. It will be forwarded directly to the studio.
Mongolia. Now, last week, there was some controversy in the pop quiz over the answer, right? So we should set this up here. Let's see. I'm trying to get the cut here. So we're going to play for you exactly what happened. There was an issue with the answer. Right, Doc?
Yes, there was an issue with the answer because we wanted to know the location of the factory that Hermann Hollerith had for making his tabulation machines.
So let's go back. Let's play what happened last week, and then we'll go into this in depth.
I was talking about Hermann Hollerith. He is the father of modern machine data processing. Of course, he invented the Hollerith punch card, and he produced equipment for the U.S. Census. Where was his factory located that he used to produce all this tabulating equipment? Where was this factory located? The town that it was located in.
Herb, good morning. You were the first in.
Okay, stop. Uh-huh. What town was it located in? This is where we're going to have problems.
Hollerith. Where was the factory located where he made all of his tabulating
okay.
machines?
31st Street. Near the canal in Washington, D.C.
That's correct, right?
Yeah, we'll be close enough.
You see. Well, there you go.
Close enough. Georgetown, but that's part of Washington, D.C., so we're going to give you credit for that.
Okay, so you knew right off the bat that there was an issue with this. Now, when you asked the question first, you said, what town? But the second time you asked the question, you left that part out.
So here's the thing. Of course, Mr. Big Voice in the studio is the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And what Mr. Big Voice told me, he said, actually, Georgetown is a section of Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would and he gave us the street address with Washington, D.C., which actually locates it. If you'd say Georgetown, it would go right there. So Mr. Big Boy said that was okay.
I think we're okay here.
I think we're okay, but here's the thing. Georgetown was a separate entity until 1871.
Right.
So it turns out, you see, that we had to do a little work because Hollerith built his factory in 1890. So the question was Georgetown separate from Washington, D.C. in 1890, or was a part of Washington? And when we checked the history, and of course, Mr. Big Voice already knew this.
Of course
when
he
we
did.
Checked, when we checked the history, it was actually part of Washington, D.C. after 1871.
Well, so I think we're okay.
Okay, very good.
I mean, that's just me, but, you know.
Well, I've got to go with Mr. Big Boy.
I think we're going to have a problem this week again.
Okay.
I think so. Let's go to line three. This is Carol calling from Silver Spring. Carol, good morning. How are you, ma'am?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Okay, Doc, ask the question.
Yes, earlier in the show, I was talking about Jen Sung Huang, the co-founder and CEO of NVIDIA. What sport did he become very effective at while he was growing up?
Was that ping pong?
Wait a minute.
Uh-oh.
See...
Yeah.
When we were discussing this.
Uh-huh.
Now, is it the same sport, different name?
No, I'm going to accept that. Because
you're going to accept that?
Ping pong and table tennis are correct.
Okay, very good. All right.
But this is like another controversy.
See, I like manufacturing controversy whenever possible.
But see, we would not have accepted
floor tennis,
window tennis, but ping pong
table
and
rugby,
table,
table rugby would not have been
acceptable. Ping pong and table tennis are one and the same thing.
Carol, thank you so much for listening. Yes. Stand by. We're going to hand you over to Andrew, who is much gentler and smarter than both of us, and she will take your information and get you your prize. You are listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. We will be back with more of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio.
Another kind.
I
like that because everybody's got ping pong. Oh, that's the table.
Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Dropcam sold to Nest for $555 million. Now, Dropcam is a five-year-old San Francisco company founded by Greg Duffy and Amir Virani. It's a simple internet camera that you can set up to watch your houses or place of business. You can pay for cloud storage for videos if you want. 39% of its customers actually pay for the cloud. Now, Dropcam started out as a side project to help Duffy's dad, who was trying to find out which of the neighborhood dogs was pooping in his backyard. And Greg's dad kept fiddling with the webcams. They couldn't get them to work because they kept like storing huge amounts of video. They just clog up his hard drive because they were always on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like totally frustrated. So Duffy and his friend thought, okay, this is not a bad idea. This might be the next big idea for a home surveillance camera. And it only would turn on when it detected motion, and it would store the videos in the cloud. So they started building this thing for Duffy's dad, and thing was working pretty well. And they said, well, let's make a company out of it. They tried to raise money. Nobody's interested. And finally, Mitch Kapoor kicked in a little seed money as an angel investor. Now, of course, Kapoor was a guy who would, you might remember, he founded Lotus Development, and he made early spreadsheets for the PC, which called Lotus 1-2-3, and he made money from that. So then he became an angel investor. Now, Duffy and Virani wrote most of the original code themselves and created the product and launched Dropcam in 2005. In the early days, Duffy and Virani packed and shipped every single Dropcam themselves. But finally, once they got Kapoor on board, then they had some cred. And other people said, okay, well, we'll invest. They eventually raised $48 million from two additional rounds of financing. And last week, they sold the Google Nest for $555 million. Mm. And they want everyone to know that Duffy's dad did catch the dog and apparently still has the video to prove it.
Amazing. These prices that the internet concerns are paying for things. We had the tech crash. Are we looking for something else? Is this going to happen
again?
Well,
it turns out that this Dropcam, this is the number one selling surveillance camera on Amazon,
mm-hmm.
the number one selling camera. So they've got an enormous market penetration, and this fits into the Google Nest vision of Internet of Things. So they said, look, this is the leading camera out there, so let's just buy it. And they're just going to add it to their suite of where he's got the CO2 detector and the thermostat. And they're going to start adding more and more devices.
I'm looking up. I've never seen a drop cam before. I want to see what the device itself looks like.
It's nice. It's a cute little device. And, they're not really that expensive. Okay, the FAA says that drones are for hobbyists only. This Monday, they released their new policy. They pointed out that delivering packages for a fee, even if it's free shipping as part of Amazon Prime, would be categorized as commercial use and not allowed unless it was licensed. They noted that taking real estate pictures to help the sales process would be commercial use and not allowed. They also noted that delivering beer to ice fishermen in Wisconsin would not be permitted because there was a guy who had a cease and desist order from FAA because he was delivering beer by drone to one of the Great Lakes. So all commercial applications require a license. To date, the FAA has only granted one commercial license for a drone. It's for oil companies to monitor the conditions in the Arctic. Mm-hmm. That's the only one they get. 3D printing. We talked about that briefly with David last week. Obama is getting his own 3D printed bust.
I'm
3D printed, you know.
Oh, yeah, like a sculpture.
Sculpture, yeah. It's going to go on display June 18th, and it's at the first ever White House Maker Fair. It's a celebration of students and entrepreneurs who are using technology to create new products and businesses. A team of the Smithsonian 3D imaging specialists scanned the president earlier this year. They used University of Southern California's Light Stage Face Scanner to capture Obama's face in high resolution and a handheld 3D scanner and single-lens reflex cameras to create a reconstruction of his bust. Autodesk produced a high-resolution model that were printed using 3D Systems selective laser sintering printers. The scans and printed models will become part of a collection at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, which showcases multiple images of each president, and this will be the first 3D printed sculpture of any president.
That's pretty cool. Do you know what medium they're going? Is this going to be the plastic that they're going to use to make this, or do you know?
It I saw a picture of it on there. I think they could do it. I think it's going to be initially in some kind of plastic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Smithsonian launched the 3D scanning and imaging program called Smithsonian X3D in 2013 to make its museum collections of scientific specimens more widely available. Now, the Smithsonian X3D collection includes models of the Wright Flyer, the Cunard biplane that was the first ever, you know, heavier-than-air-powered aircraft, the remnants of the supernova Cassiopeia A, a whale fossil, a 6th-century Buddha statue. These objects are available online, so anyone with a 3D printer can print them at home.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
That's kind of interesting.
I think it's worth a trip to the Smithsonian too.
I think it is. And then they're getting 3D printers that are cheaper than them. So I guess you can print your own artwork at home now if you just get your own 3D printer.
Hmm.
Denial of service attacks are getting worse. Now, a denial of service attack is when hackers flood a website or an application with just pointless requests over and over and over again, and they clog or overwhelm the resources to shut it down. So the services are denied to other people because they've just loaded it up, they've clogged it up. Most are distributed denial of service attacks, which means that they originate from multiple computers all focused in on the same website. So the sources are distributed. So the distributed, and it also makes them harder to block, because if it was all coming from one computer, you could easily block that IP address. But if they come from all over the place, it's very hard to block everything. Now, distributed denial of service spikes are getting higher and higher and higher. They were peaking at 320 gigabits per second. There was a 320 gigabit per second attack in February. That's a huge spike. A single distributed denial of service surge of 100 gigabits per second is enough to disrupt most corporate networks. So there was one last, in February, 320, which is three times what it takes to disrupt a corporate network. Now, attacks that are larger than 20 gigabits per second rose eightfold in 2013 compared to 2012. One attack in June of 2014 brought down Facebook for 30 minutes. That, wow. that was a distributed denial of service attack. In April, as of April 2014, NorthStar Security Operations Center had already dealt with more than twice as many 100 gigabit plus attacks compared to last year, and we were only in April. The average distributed denial of service attack has gone up in size, but it's still in the range of 1 to 5 gigabits per second. Now, the source and destinations of these attacks vary widely. However, the United States and China are the most attacked countries. They are also the source of most of the attacks. Huh. So we're the most attacked, and we also do the most attack in. Mm-hmm. Remember that heartbeat vulnerability that we talked about in the open SSL that was out there? Well, 2 months ago, there was this major bug in the secure socket layer encryption. It was in the open SSL software package that was actually the cause, and it was called Heart Bleed because a portion of it, the heartbeat section of it, was actually had a flaw that would reveal, you know, what should have been encrypted data.
Sure.
And so 2 months ago, there were over 1 million servers at risk. I mean, it was a huge deal because people were afraid that all their passwords are going to be done, and then everybody, there were then all the major services rushed to upgrade their service and put in the latest patch to OpenSSL. But researcher Robert David Graham has gone back and looked at it, and he said there's still 300,000 sites that are vulnerable. So even though it's been out for 2 months, there are 300,000 sites that are still vulnerable. Now, immediately after the announcement, it went from 1 million to 600,000 sites. So 400,000 sites cleaned it up right away. So all the big ones like Google, Yahoo, all these guys cleaned it up right away. Then a month after it, the number of vulnerable sites dropped to 318,000. Then in the second month, it only dropped down 9,000 more. So from one month, it was 318 are vulnerable. After 2 months, 309,000 are vulnerable. So it looks like about 300,000 sites are just not doing anything.
Uh-huh.
So this is actually a real danger now because this exploit's been so highly publicized, and it's very easy for people to scan and find out which servers are vulnerable. So if you've got, you know, a small web server or a small server open to the internet, make certain that your IT department has patched it because it could be a problem. Okay, the Saudi government is targeting dissidents with malware. Now, Human Rights Watch on Friday demanded a clarification from the Saudi government over allegations from security researchers that the kingdom is infecting and monitoring dissidents' mobile phones. Now, the Civil Rights Watchdog said that this software was allegedly produced by an Italian hacking team, and it mostly targeted individuals in the Qatif district in Eastern Province, which has been the site of sporadic Shiite-led protests since February 2011. The spyware allows the government to see the phone's call history. It allows to see text messages, contacts, emails, and files. It also allows them to turn on the phone's camera or microphone to take pictures and to record conversations without the owner's knowledge. It was embedded in a doctored version of an existing application. So, actually, that's. I think we're going to start seeing more and more of this kind of stuff. So just be mindful when you start loading on an application on your cell phone.
On your cell phone. Yeah. I was looking at the drop cam online here. That's a neat looking little camera, and it's compact. You can stick it on a wall.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's a very nice look. What's the price? It's not much.
The DropCam Pro is $199. Which has all kinds of neat features. Now the DropCam, I don't have the page up for the other one, but it looks like it's compatible to both Mac and PC.
Oh.
So you can use it, you know, whatever computer you've got.
Because it's a Wi-Fi connection.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good.
Very good. Okay, thanks for listening. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More tech news coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Google is offering free coding lessons to women and minorities. They are paying for three free months for any woman or minority interested in tech to expand their skills. This is part of their $50 million Made with Code initiative. Google said they have available vouchers for women, and it numbers in the thousands. This new initiative comes just days after Google published a diversity report that revealed only 30% of its employees are women, and African American and Hispanics only comprise 1% to 2% of Google's tech employees, and they want to fix that. And they said the only way they can fix it is to get people who know how to code who, you know, are more diverse. Now, the Labor Department says that only 20% of software developers in the U.S. are women, and only 12% of computer science degrees go to women. I've got a link. It's a very complicated link here that takes you right to the page where you can sign up for this this coding voucher. It took me a while to get the page. They're giving away these vouchers at various conferences, but if you look around, and I looked around, I finally found the link where you can put in your name and address. And not everybody's going to get it. They have so many. But I'll tell you, if you're a woman or a minority, I'd recommend that it's 3 months of free code education.
Why would they make it so difficult to get to the coupon?
I don't know.
It's Google. Everything with Google is so easy.
Maybe they don't have an unlimited number of vouchers. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but you go to the Tech Talk outline. It'll be posted to the website on Monday, and the link is going to be right there for you. Well, let's talk about my first experiences on the internet.
Yes.
Let's go back through memory lane. Memory lane. It's just, I started thinking about the back in the good old days when I was just getting onto the internet. And if you remember, Microsoft didn't notice that the internet was coming along. They sort of forgot about the internet. So I had a Windows machine, and there was no protocol stack for internet, which was native with Windows. Mm-hmm. Windows had no way to get on the internet. You need what they call a protocol stack, and to do that. And so there's a guy in Australia that wrote a program called WinSoc, which was Windows Socket, because if you take a particular protocol stack, you've got an IP address and a port. It's called a socket. You can connect directly to a program. That's what was called WinSoc.
Makes sense.
I downloaded this thing from this Australian website, and I installed WebSoc. But then I found this internet in a box. So I was out shopping,
You're at the internet store.
It's at the internet store, and so it was like $40, like internet in a box. So I bought internet in a box. It was sold by Spry Incorporated, and they were just starting up a commercial internet service called InterServe. Now, iBox included WinSoc, which was actually, if you already had it, that was the TCP/IP protocol stack. And then I was running it, that I installed on Windows. It also included a licensed copy of the Mosaic web browser. See, back in the beginning, You had to buy the web browser. You see, this was before Microsoft Internet Explorer. Uh-huh. So you had to buy the web browser. So I'd included a licensed copy of the NCSA Mosaic web browser. It was called Air Mosaic. It also included Air Mail, which is an email client, Air uh-huh. News, which was a news client, Air Telnet, Air Gopher, and Air and FTP. In an FTP client, so you could upload files. Gopher was a program to sort of look. You said it was like a search engine. You say, well, I'm kind of interested in looking for something, and it looks all over the internet for files that have that name.
That's a cool name for
a
search.
So it was like your internet Gopher. Hey, Gopher, go find this for me.
Mm-hmm.
So Gopher is now Google, I guess.
But, probably.
So that's what I had, and it also included InterServe's dial-up access. So I dial up. I mean, I was
good
thinking
grief.
Back. I dial up, and it
took forever, probably.
It was a full package, but I'm telling you, I was really excited with that. I was, I didn't realize. I mean, of course, I was on the internet, so it didn't seem that slow to me at the time. Now, if I'd go back, I think it would be extremely terrible.
Uh-huh.
It also included Ed Kroll's book, The Whole Internet User's Guide and Catalog. So with this internet in a box, it was just.
How popular was this thing?
It was pretty popular, I think. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Not many of my neighbors had internet in a box.
You really had to be interested in technology
I was interested in technology. It was really nice because I had actually been because when I worked with because I'd always been on the DARPAnet. I'd been on the internet that DARPA. This was the precursor of the internet, the military network. So I'd been on the DARPAnet for a long time, for years. And so I'd been using email clients on the DARPAnet at work. But of course, that was all classified stuff. It was all DOD kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I'd used the ARPANET for a long time. So this whole idea of having a private network was kind of a new deal, and so this was my first experience to have that at home. I really did enjoy that.
So how long did you wind up using this for?
Probably 2 years.
Uh-huh. And then the internet came along and eventually
Microsoft had Internet Explorer, so
right.
you didn't need Mosaic. Microsoft then eventually included a TCP/IP protocol stack in there with one of their upgrades, so you didn't need WinSock. And then I ended up just getting another dial-up internet service provider, and so it was just gradually, I just gradually sort of evolve into this, but I'll tell you, the presence of the internet really did change my whole perception of what a computer could be.
Sure.
And I just really enjoyed using that. And I mean, I didn't get much email back. People weren't on email then.
No.
So, maybe you'd get like 5 or 6 emails a day. Now I get boatloads of emails a day. So it's a.
So this is sort of like, you talk about people, you're interested in doing something, go out and do it. This falls into that category, but way in its early stages, right?
So this was in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And you see I think when was Netscape? And I think the Mosaic browser came out in 92, 93. That's mm-hmm. when the World Wide Web was created. And then probably Netscape was 1995. The original DARPAnet came out in the late 80s. So I'd been playing around with that for a while. Wow, this show just went so fast.
Yep.
Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. We'd also like you to go to the Stratford University website. That's stratford.edu, and you can check out the programs there and tell them that you heard about the programs while listening to Tech Talk Radio.
If you tuned in later or would like to hear this show again, it will replay tomorrow at 7 p.m. here on Federal News Radio. See you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio on the air at 1500. 1400 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
It's a nice day. Let's play two. We have two Nationals games, a doubleheader from the friendly confines of Wrigley Field today. Game time's at 1 o'clock and at 7 o'clock here on Federal News Radio. Here in D.C., it's going to be a lovely day, mostly sunny skies, mid-80s for the high. Right now, 75 outside our studios at 10 a.m.